Welcome to XYPN Radio, where your host, Alan Moore, brings you into a community of fee-only financial planners who want to profitably and successfully serve Gen X and Gen Y clients. If you're ready to get the knowledge you need from leaders in your field, learn from forward-thinking advisors, and take action on your own goals, XYPN Radio is the show for you. Here's your host.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of XYPN Radio. I am your host, Alan Moore, and I'm excited to have XYPN members Christina and Stephanie, founders of Mana Financial Life Design in California, on the show today. Christina started her career as a wholesaler before realizing that after talking to 10,000 advisors in 10 years, there wasn't a single one she would recommend for her friend who needed financial advice. Stephanie is a CPA and CFA who did risk analysis on hedge funds before becoming a money manager. Friends from college, they met up in Spain for a meeting of the minds and decided to launch a financial planning firm together. They didn't have enough savings to just jump in, so they found three investors to invest in their business. And we talked at length about how they structured that deal, which was fascinating to learn about and something listeners can consider for themselves. They're big believers in life planning and have incorporated the work of George Kinder and Marie Sommers to help their clients uncover what it is they really want out of life and design their life plan to help them achieve it. They've grown from scratch to almost 40 client households in their first year, so whatever they're doing is clearly working. XY Planning Network's annual benchmarking survey is out. Are you curious about the average number of clients XYPN members get in their first year, or how successful niches really are? To answer these burning questions and more, we've again enlisted a professional research firm to complete our annual benchmarking study. Get your copy hot off the press and discover vital statistics such as the median advisor revenue by years in practice and sources of firm growth, from referrals to blogging, social media, and more. Head over to xyplanningnetwork.com/study to purchase your copy today. You can find any of the additional resources that we mentioned during the episode at xyplanningnetwork.com/224. Also, be sure to go to xyplanningnetwork.com/VIP to join our private group just for XYPN Radio listeners. It's the community of advisors we've all been looking for that's there to provide support when we need it the most. Best of all, it's free. I encourage you to check it out. Again, that's xyplanningnetwork.com/VIP. Without further ado, here's my interview with Christina and Stephanie. Hey, Christina and Stephanie, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having us, Alan.
Thank you.
So let's give listeners a quick overview of the two of you and your practice, sort of where you're located, number of clients, what your niche is, and then we will dig into the details.
All right. Happy to do that. So we are Mana Financial Life Design, headquartered in Marina Del Rey, California. For those of you who have no idea where that is, that's in LA, right by the beach. We're two blocks from the ocean. And Mana Financial Life Design is really all about creating spaces for compassionate finance and leading our clients to live a life that they're excited to live today, not some arbitrary time in the future. Our client niche are really women in tech as well as in finance that are mid to late stage in their career.
So mana, can you tell me what that means?
Yeah, mana is an ancient Hawaiian word, and it means power unrelated to wealth.
Very cool. All right. I'm curious, in California, do people know what that means? Do they look it up, or is it just sort of infused into your marketing so that people sort of know what that is? Because it's a really cool reference.
Yeah,
we really love the word mana. It is, Hawaii is a very special place in both of our hearts, but for me, Christina, it was the first place that I arrived in the United States as an immigrant from the Philippines. So I've always been drawn to Hawaii, also because I'm a surfer. So mana, you know, really exudes all of that. And when we found that word for this, mana is this vital energy, we really, really both were like, this is the word. And so no, people don't typically know what it means. We have it in the bottom of every single one of our web pages, that you have the power to gain or lose mana in everything that you do.
Awesome. So yeah, it's definitely infused into what you're doing. And whenever you explain what it is briefly, it makes perfect sense. How many client households are y'all serving today?
So we have 39 client households as of today.
And you launched a year and a couple months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So we started taking on clients in September of 2018, and we started from scratch. So it's been a fun journey over the past year.
That you are skewing my benchmarking survey data then. So, all right, we will dig into that. That'll be fun to talk about. So let's just take a step back and talk about career history. So whichever one of you wants to start, maybe Stephanie, we'll start with you. So can you just tell me a little bit about how you got into financial planning?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my career in accounting. I graduated with a major in accounting from Bucknell University, and then I went to work at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I was auditing hedge funds during the financial crisis. So,
what fun. You
know, oh, yeah. So when you graduate from college, I don't know. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted it to be complicated. So I kind of dived right into that. Ended up going to work for a hedge fund after Pricewaterhouse, which was acquired by Man Group, which is the world's largest publicly traded hedge fund. And during that time, I spent my career in risk management. So it was really like looking at these hedge funds and first making sure that they couldn't steal our cash and that they weren't a fraud, but then also making sure that they were risk managed from an investment perspective. So really started off on the institutional side. I ended up about 5 years ago going managing individual money. And it was the first time that I had actually done this for individuals and totally fell in love with the business. I just found so much more value in providing investment advice to people than large institutions because I really got to know the people. And then ended up getting drawn to the financial planning industry because I just saw that there was a big gap in what I was able to provide. I was like, fine on the investment side, but people just need so much more than that. So that's, I'll let Christina tell her path because they merge really at that point.
So Stephanie doesn't like to brag about herself, so I do it for her. She also got her CFA and CPA before the age of 26.
Wow. So you were studying for both of them at the same time?
It was just, I graduated from college at 21 and then just dove right in. So it's a
It's good advice for young people listening. Just go ahead and knock it out because there's never a good time to sit for the CFA and to spend 3 years of your life studying that. But you might as well do it when you're young and maybe have some time.
Yeah. And don't require much sleep because that's what you give up.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, yeah. I guess let me ask, how do you feel like the CPA and CFA have influenced, I guess, the work that you're doing now? I mean, are you really leveraging the education and the skill set that you learned there, or was that really for your previous jobs and now it's shifted a little bit?
I mean, I actually use my CPA now more than ever. It's really awesome to like have something that I did at the very start of my career become so relevant now. And I mean, the CFA as well, it prepares you for a lot of the different aspects of what we do in financial planning. I'm a pretty technical minded person. So, you know, I'm always thinking about problem solving from a technical perspective whenever it comes to the numbers. So I think a great deal of what I learned is incorporated in a lot of what I do today.
Awesome. So Christina, can you give us a little bit of background on yourself?
Yeah. So also graduated from Bucknell University. That's where Stephanie and I met, with a degree in political science. So absolutely nothing to do with finance. I wanted to go change the world, but unfortunately I couldn't because I was saddled with $100,000 in student loan debt. So what I did was I went to find a job in 2006 in a career that I felt could pay me the most so I could pay off the student loans as fast as possible. So went into finance and got a job right out of school at Lord Abbott, an asset manager. And so I spent about 2 years there and kind of loved the idea of what I did. I was an internal wholesaler. So I was the product person, the nasty product person. So I went out and the first 2 years I was dialing for dollars. I, you know, made 100 dials a day for 2 years, really building the skill of just not being afraid to speak to anyone. And that led to, you know, my competitive edge of really wanting to be the best. And so I got a job right out of Lord Abbott with Russell Investments for an entire decade, where I was the youngest wholesaler for probably most of that decade at Russell Investments. I was the 24-year-old, where a lot of my colleagues were 50-year-old men. So I spent 10 years basically knocking on financial advisors' doors and really building relationships. And at the end of that 10 years, I calculated I'd met with over 10,000 financial advisors in the broker-dealer, RIA, wirehouse world. And so really, the pivotal point came when, you know, when I turned 30, a dear friend lost her mom and reached out to me and said, what do I do now? And of the 10,000 advisors you've met, who do you recommend? Like someone that you'd recommend to your parents. And I drew a blank. I literally couldn't think of anyone. So from there, I just kind of knew. I was like, okay, I guess this is my life's calling now. I gotta build something where I can feel comfortable recommending their services, our services, to, you know, anyone that I meet. And so basically started studying for the CFP, went back to UCLA while working full time, and then also met George Kinder at that time and became a registered life planner. And that's really, you know, starting to dream. And after George Kinder's 5-day training, my vision was lit up so much that I knew I had a 2-year path forward. And I knew that 2018 was the year. And that's when Stephanie and I started to talk.
So going back a little bit, so when you did the Dialing for Dollars for a couple of years, it sounds like you had some success. When you transitioned over to working with advisors, do you just sort of walk away from that income and that revenue stream? Were you still working with clients at that point?
I've never worked with clients until we worked at Mana.
Okay, so that was dialing on financial advisors at that time.
Correct. So when I said knocking on doors, I meant knocking on, you know, like the Wells Fargo advisor's door at, you know, in Westwood in Los Angeles.
So can you tell me, like, that people ask me, you know, how do I get into financial planning? There's no fee-only RIAs in my area. Should I go, you know, wholesale, knock on doors? Should I go work for IBD and all the different options? I mean, do you feel like that experience has given you the tools that you needed to be successful now? Do you feel like it was just, you know, it was a job and you made money, but you didn't necessarily learn any skills that have been valuable long-term for you?
Oh, no, absolutely. I one of the reasons I counsel a lot of wholesalers today, I mean, it's an industry that clearly with consolidation and fee compression has really changed dramatically over the past decade. But that's not to say that there isn't a lot to learn. I mean, I went to tons of conferences where I learned from, you know, best of breed asset managers, as well as financial planners. You know, I got to man the booth at all the FPA conferences in Southern California. But I also learned, you know, Stephanie and I always talk about this, that we created Mana from all of the best ideas from all of our industry experience. And so I learned a lot of business practices through working with IBD, RIAs, and wirehouses. And I learned what to do and also what not to do.
Okay. So would you recommend that career path for a young person trying to get into financial planning of, you know, hey, it may not be the most ideal path, but it is a path that you can walk?
It's a question that I feel a bit conflicted, I guess. But I guess I would say it depends. I think it depends on who you work for. The annuity wholesaler, I'd probably guide them against not doing that. However, if you work for, let's say, you know, an asset manager that has model portfolios, right, and sells those to financial advisors, and it becomes more of a practice management role versus a, you know, a specific product sale, then I would say that is a great way. And it's also a great way to build your Rolodex.
Yeah. I mean, Christina and I talk about this a lot where, you know, our paths are very different in terms of getting into financial planning, but we wouldn't have the firm we have today if it weren't for those experiences. So I don't think we can be so prescriptive to say like, this is definitely a path to take, but I think that our business is built upon a lot of different ideas in terms of what an ideal financial planning firm should look like. A lot of it came from Christina's practice management and then my operationalizing everything.
Yeah, no, I love that point because I have come to realize, so we have our MES program, our Member Experience Specialist program, where we're hiring people from, you know, outside the industry that are coming in and working with our members, connecting them to resources. And within about a year, they've all turned into business coaches, which is kind of like, that wasn't the intention, but they talk to, you know, they talk to a group of advisors, but throughout the year, but they're probably having I don't know, 700 or 800 phone calls a year. And so by the time you have 700 phone calls a year, just like you did in terms of calling on all those advisors, you just start to learn, right? And you start to spot good things and bad things. And so it is a really interesting point that, you know, there are ways to learn sort of practice management techniques and such that honestly, you don't learn in a financial planning firm because it's only one firm. You know, as an associate advisor, you may not even be purview or privy to those conversations. So I'm with you that I don't know that there's an ideal path that's out there. We all just have our own path, but I get that question a lot of, should I take this job or should I keep looking? And it's like, you know, hard for me to say, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think starting off in some of the big companies, you get thrown in the mix of a lot of different problem solving. So, you know, it's good experience. I definitely don't think we'd be the business owners that we are today if we didn't have it.
So can you talk to me about the conversation that ultimately sparked the two of you going into business together?
Ah, yes.
It's our favorite. Yeah.
Sitting in San Sebastian, Spain. So in May of 2018, I went to visit Christina in San Sebastian, Spain. And during that time, we were just starting to talk about kind of what's next, what's the path forward, really thinking about our lives and what we want to do. And this is something that we've been talking about for kind of the years before, just brainstorming it. But San Sebastian became a real reality because we were with one of our mentors, and in talking to her, it was sort of like, okay, well, we're going to need to figure out like how we're getting paid for a business. I mean, starting from scratch is really crazy. There's a lot of unknown that we just are unaware of. And she chimed up, well, why don't you get investors?
And so once that came up, like, oh, so as a backdrop, Stephanie and I both had high paying jobs, but like most people in, you know, finance in New York City, we spent a lot of it. We can talk about that in a little bit. I had about 5 years of time to save after that moment that I talked about earlier. And Stephanie also had like no idea that this business was coming down the pike. So we understood also listening to your podcast and looking at all the benchmarking surveys that, you know, advisor firms don't really start making money for 3 years. And so for us, we wanted to say, okay, like, how do we creatively think about that, given the fact that, you know, Stephanie and I both are going to need to get paid very soon. I'm planning on starting a family very soon. And so I think we approached it very differently. And again, thinking outside the box, we decided to take on 3 investors who are our mentors as well to help us start the business. And so on that dining room table in San Sebastian, Spain, Stephanie, the Excel guru, starts putting together numbers, and I start writing out a business plan. And that's when it all started. And 2 months later, we hooked up with XYPN and started our firm.
All right. I was not aware that you had investors, and I'm not sure I have heard of firms starting with investors. So talk to me about that. How did you find them? And sort of, if you can talk about, you know, some of the deal structure and how you were able to structure this so it was, you know, comfortable for both sides.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of work on the structuring side, just in doing venture capital analysis and helping people on private equity. So from a structure side, I knew that we needed kind of the legal construct to set it up. So we actually have 2 LLCs. Our investors are invested in the parent company. The parent company, they have convertible notes in the parent company, and we pay them a fixed rate of interest over the next 3 years, and then they can convert to equity.
So convertible notes, for people who don't come from this world, I didn't know what these were until we started raising money at AdvicePay. So it's essentially a loan that isn't priced on any type of, you know, what's the valuation of the business. It's just, here's X number of dollars and you pay an interest. It's just, it is a loan. But in 3 years, they have the option to convert it to equity, or maybe they have to convert it to equity, and you sort of price the valuation at that time. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm making up numbers. You don't have to share exact numbers. Let's say they gave you $100,000, and in 3 years, based on a formula, you agree the business is worth $1 million. They get 10% of the equity. If it's worth $200,000, they get 50% of the equity. And there's usually caps and minimums, and you know that. Well, you know, just to be sure that, just in case you're worth $10 million, because you knock it out of the park, they still get a minimum amount of equity. So is that pretty much the way it got structured?
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, the terms were, they were friends and family and mentors. So, you know, we had a lot of discussions in terms of where we're looking to take the business and how it's going to grow. And so we were all comfortable with that arrangement.
We also, Alan, it also probably deserves to be said that the reason why we also have two companies is because we built an RIA in addition to a online financial education company, where we are producing financial literacy videos by the name of Mana Money School. And so that funding helped us in the creation of those for the year that we spent in production for Mana Money School.
So you have parent company, which then owns the two LLCs. One is the RIA, one is the financial literacy company.
So the parent company owns the financial literacy company. And then the other LLC is the RIA.
Let's see. I have so many questions about having investors. This is awesome. Do they, is the, well, two, I guess two primary things. One, have you already set the valuation formula? That's something I'm always curious about. Like, have you already said it's, you know, we're worth 2x revenue whenever we get to that point, or will you, you know, have it appraised by FP Transitions?
Yeah. So, yeah. So one of the things that I knew from being a wholesaler was that the valuation metrics were so disparate. And they continue to evolve. And so we basically said we will be hiring a third party that Stephanie and I vet beforehand, because we know there's FP Transitions, there's also Live Oak, there's a lot of different companies that are doing that. And so our job for the next 3 years is to really kind of watch this valuation side of the business and see who's the leading, you know, firm valuation company at that point.
Do you expect, well, one, do they have to convert or do they have the option to convert?
They have the option to convert. I mean, look, it's subject to being able to pay back cash. So, you know, at that 3 year mark, it's really, that's how the discussion will start, where, you know, we have a responsibility to build the cash surplus at that point. But, you know, it is an ongoing discussion. We talk to them every single month. So they're very well aware of all that we do.
So it will convert to equity at that point, and then the plan is to buy them out, or will they remain investors?
There's no plan to buy them out. We want to give them the option. The reason why we picked these three investors is because the three of them we view as like our greatest mentors in our lives. So they, you know, we have them there, you know, one is in our industry and the other two are not. And they provide such valuable insight and wisdom
and love.
Yeah. And just, they love us. And so we really appreciate them.
This is the first time I've heard of this structure. That's why I'm asking all the nitty gritty questions, because this is a really cool structure. So you mentioned that you're meeting with them monthly. And so tell me about those meetings. Is this a board meeting where all of you are getting together? Or are you just having a call with each of the three? Is it more business coaching than it is, you know, update on the business? Sort of what does that look like for y'all?
Yeah, it's two parts. So we always do them on Zoom because two of our investors are not in LA. And so we'll do them at the end of the month when our books for the previous month have been closed. And so I'd say half the meeting is just reviewing P&L and talking about, you know, wins and losses. And then the other one is really just like strategizing about right now, this quarter, it's all about, you know, end of the year, what are our KPIs? And what are the things that we should be focusing our time and energy on?
So they really are helping also just give feedback. And as you said, mentors, not maybe from the industry or maybe not, depending on which one you're talking to, but able to give valuable feedback, not just, you know, it wasn't just money. It came with business savvy as well.
I think one of the most valuable things that comes out of these meetings is Christina and I explain what we're doing. And if they don't get it, then we know we're not explaining it well. And so that's been kind of a constant feedback loop in terms of us changing our process, changing our fee structure, like really like getting into what this business should look like. Because if our own investors can't understand something, then clearly it's not going to resonate with people outside of our business.
Yeah, I'm in a study group of local business owners here in Bozeman, and one of them recently raised capital. They were a mature firm, but one of the things that they said that happened that was sort of unexpected was they were like, all of a sudden we now actually have to produce quarterly reports and we have to actually look at our P&L. if nothing else, the investor sort of served as this accountability partner, you know, because if it's just one of you or just the two of you, it's really easy to just sort of ignore it and never update your books. And then at the end of the year, it's tax time and you haven't touched your books for a year. We see this all the time at FAB encounters. You know, it's easy to do that. When you have investors, you don't have that luxury. You sort of have to look at your metrics and your KPIs and your P&L because you have to be able to send that report. And if you don't, they start asking for it. So kind of a nice way to have an accountability built in.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I realized that very quickly that, you know, is despite being an Excel whiz, even though we're doing this, you know, we're helping clients with their own money management, it's really good to ask for help on your own stuff because just having that accountability partner really makes a huge difference.
So how did you decide how much money to take? Because in the end, I mean, basically what you were deciding is how much equity in your company to give away, you know, to give away or to give up. And so did you just sort of, you know, make conservative estimates and back into it? And I'm assuming some of that money is being used for personal expenses because you mentioned that, you know, need to still be able to maintain that paycheck. So this is business and personal, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really a matter of putting together the projections. So whenever we put together the projections, you know, I was like, Christina, how much can you sell? Okay, this is how much we'll spend. All right, let's do this.
I love financial projections because they're just totally made up numbers. But
that's right.
You know, this is one of those things. It's easy to make up numbers for yourself and be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll do these numbers. But again, when you're deciding, because you could have taken too much money. If instead of whatever the number is, instead of taking $200,000, you take $600,000 because you think you need it. Well, you just gave up three times more of your business in terms of equity. So how are you doing in terms of, you know, budget to actual? So are you hitting your projections? Are you ahead of them? Are you a little behind?
So it was a sad recognition to realize that we were behind to start. But since then, we've really, like, we adjusted expectations for everything going forward. So now we're going off of our new projections, in which case we have something reasonable to actually beat. So whenever we started, it was kind of this one, you know, what our understanding of what we would do would be. And it was pretty deflating, to be honest, where you would have these conversations and it was like, and we didn't do it again.
So our investors were actually the ones that said, hey guys, don't be too hard on yourselves. Why don't you redo the projections and let's hold you accountable to that? And that was just a huge weight off our shoulders. And we redid them in January and we've been, crushing it ever since.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, a lot of the work that we do with our clients is this like money accountability and coaching and really being there for them. And it's really cool to see how our investors are doing that for us in the same way.
Yeah.
No, that's fantastic. And honestly, it's a good reason to have investors on that convertible note format because quite honestly, you took the risk in a way. I mean, yes, they may never get their money back because the whole business doesn't work, but like they're probably going to get their money back. And so you took on the risk because of the variability there. So it allows them to not be so high pressure and be like, hey, WTF. You know, like go hit those projections because I own 30% of your company. Instead, it's like, hey, like just let's figure this out and, you know, it'll be fine. So I imagine that takes a little bit of pressure off.
Yeah, for sure.
So you were at 39 clients. I would love to see the initial projections to know where, you know, like y'all, you know, coming out of the gate screaming. I love it.
I think I've blacked them out. I actually have no idea what we initially projected now.
Wildly unrealistic.
Where has the growth come from? I mean, because this is, I mean, that is just exceptional growth for the stage that you're in. So where are you seeing the success, you know, from a growth perspective?
Yeah, the cool thing is we look at this every month and it's been so interesting to see how much broader our kind of centers of influence have become. And so in the beginning, we sent out, I mean, again, Alan, we'd never done this before. So I'm an eternal optimist and Stephanie always brings me back down, right? And so to reality. So we sent out an email to all of our network and just announced that we had launched Mana. And we were, you know, so excited. We thought we'd bring on like 10 clients that first month. It was more like five. Really, what has gotten us to the growth that we've gotten to is continuing to spread our message through various channels. So one of our dear friends is the president of a big brand here in LA, and they are in fashion, and they interviewed us about managing money because, you know, that was something that they wanted to build a lifestyle blog. Well, that brought us a number of people to our website and future clients. And that really kind of started this whole other ripple effect of other people in different industries that were really interested in Mana's approach of compassionate finance, because money is so scary and anxiety inducing for so many that when they even just opened up our webpage and saw that it was pink and there were flowers on it, there are two women running this firm, that they knew that it was a different approach. And really, that's kind of opened up doors where we're doing workshops in some of the key cities that we operate in, and we're continually blogging about our work. And so the SEO optimization has also helped us bring in new clients.
Another thing is Christina is so on it on our Instagram. So she posts 3 times a week, and that's consistent since she started that. And it's been really cool because even though Instagram isn't really turning, it's not like a direct, oh, okay, I saw this and I'm becoming a client. What it is doing is it's keeping us fresh in people's minds. So when they have people in their lives that they realize could use the financial support, they're thinking of us. And so it's at least getting us, you know, an opportunity to speak with people that we might not otherwise have spoken with.
Talking to advisors like yourselves make me feel so old because I'm like, I don't have Instagram and people are on Snapchat. I'm just like, oh man, I just not even, but I'm also not your target market. So that's totally fine for you. You know, when you first started, you had sort of a niche in mind, and that niche has evolved, it sounds like. So can you talk to me about sort of the evolution of your target market and how that has sort of accelerated the growth that you've experienced?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just like most people who start up an advisory business, we kind of took a pulse of people who had indicated interest about our work. And, you know, we had this idea, like we had a couple of people that worked abroad and were US citizens. And we had a couple of people that were women in finance. So we're like, okay, maybe our niche can be, you know, expats and women in finance. Sounds great. What we started doing was we brought them on as clients and we started doing the work. And we realized how hard it was to serve the expat community without fully being part of that community and dedicating 100% of our time and energy to that. And so we started, you know, in December, we started looking at that, the initial client base. And we realized that we really had two demographics that were coming to us more often. One was these women in finance, because they were our past community of our careers. And then the other one were actually women in tech. So our expat clients were women in tech, and they were referring us women within the United States that were doing this. And we said, oh, okay, maybe this is our niche, because Stephanie's tax background gives her a huge leg up when it comes to the stock compensation. And both of these demographics are people that are tending to go through life transitions and are really drawn to the financial life planning aspect of what we're doing. What we've also found is that though we say that niche is women in tech and women in finance, 50% of our client base are men. And they're either the husbands of these women or they're men in tech or men in finance that also resonate with this life design that we do.
So is it fair to say that you sort of started out with a profession-based niche, but it sounds like it's really evolving into more the niche of the service that you're offering in the fact that it is life planning and that's, yes, you're still, you know, primarily working with women in finance and tech, but that maybe the financial life planning has become the niche?
Yeah, it's an interesting observation because, you know, a lot of the work that we do just from a more technical side does really serve the people in finance and in tech. But you're right in that people who come to us have a certain openness. Most of them haven't worked with a financial advisor in the past, and they're really looking for something, I mean, holistic, of course, but I think something about the life planning and really having that message resonate with them and being open to exploring their dreams in a way that, you know, maybe you wouldn't get in a traditional financial planning shop.
So for people who are not familiar with George Kinder, he's sort of the father of life planning and we'll say incorporating psychology and money, because come to find out, they are inextricably linked and that it's not just dollars and cents. And so can you just tell me what drew you to his program? And maybe you have to go into the details of the program itself, but maybe just talk to me about how you've incorporated what you've learned through Kinder's training with the RLP and how that influences the work that you're doing with clients.
Sure. Yeah. And actually, so back in when I was 30, 5 years ago, a dear friend of mine who was an advisor gave me the 7 Stages of Money Maturity book. And I wept. I found myself weeping at some of the stories. And just, I had this aha moment of like, oh my gosh, this is what's missing in the advisor's practices that I, you know, don't feel comfortable recommending to my parents. I got to find out more. I found out that there was a 5-day retreat happening in Hana, Maui, again, Hawaii, bringing me back. And I said, yes, I'm going to go do that. So I was the only, you know, clearly the only wholesaler in the group of 12 that was at that 5-day training a few years back. It was at that time that George Kinder actually did that, what he calls lighting the torch, which is a visual narrative of a time 2 years or 2 to 3 years in the future, where he essentially showed that it was possible for me to quit my job and start an RIA. And so we talked to a lot of people, a lot of advisors, about the idea that you really can't life plan unless you're living your own life plan and you've been life planned. And so that's really kind of like the key reason, you know, that we started the firm, was that vision was ignited. And so really what life planning is sitting down to listen to a client. So in the first meeting, our first fit meeting, Stephanie and I talk about 5% of the time. We sit and we listen to what our clients or what our prospects are really looking for in an ideal advisory relationship and what's keeping them up at night.
So 5% of the time, most advisors in that introductory meeting speak 95% of the time. So can you talk me through that meeting and how you're able to ask the right questions and then get out of the way and not feel the need to continue talking?
Yeah. I'd also say, I want to give, we were at XYPN Live and we saw Dr. Moira Summers. So I did tell her after the talk that, you know, that was another book that we read last year before we set up our whole onboarding process. So really, it's a mix of questions that George Kinder would ask, as well as Dr. Moira Summers' book of giving advice that sticks. And so the first question is always, what brings you here today? And then there's a long pause and you just let the client say whatever it is that's coming to mind. And then after they've kind of run their course, this is another technique that I relearned from George a couple weeks ago, the power of two words, anything else. And when you say anything else and you pause, there's a lot more that comes out. So it's really having the patience to hold that space in silence for your prospect so they can get it all out there. And by the end of the meeting, you know, after the anything else, we'll just go through some of the factual questions and also using some of the advice that sticks, questions of getting an idea of what their, you know, relationship with money is. Have they ever had any bad experiences? Do they feel comfortable speaking about money with the people that are closest with them? What about with other financial professionals? So really, it's all about behavior. And then we just ask some factual questions to understand the complexity of their financial life, because that's what our fees are based upon. And by the end, every single one of our clients that we've taken through this says, wow, I feel like I've really been heard in this meeting. And that's really what we want to leave our clients with after that first meeting.
Yeah, I love how you start the meeting by just asking why someone is there. You know, come to find out, no one wakes up in the morning and thinks like, hey, let's go talk to a stranger about money. That sounds like fun. They come to us for a reason. And I feel like so often our approaches, especially in that introductory meeting, don't honor the fact that they are there with a problem. and they just want help with that problem. They come in and we basically say, like, here's what we do, comprehensive financial planning. We're going to talk about everything to do in your personal financial life. And here's all the things we do. And they're like, I don't care. Like, there's, I have a, this thing that happened. My mom just died. Like, that's what I want to talk about. And so often we don't give the space and for that conversation. So, you know, it is the 7 second rule, you know, it's silence for 7 seconds before you speak again. Like, it's really hard to do. It's really awkward, but it's amazing what will come up in that when you give this space.
It's so true. I mean, and I can say firsthand that any of the clients who I was investing money for, we weren't having the same level of conversations. I'm such a believer in George Kinder's work and many of the other brilliant minds whose books we've read, because it's so powerful what people are willing to share if you're just there to listen.
So George did his 2-day. So he does a 2-day. I hear it's a tasting menu, sort of an introduction, and then the 5-day Evoke training, which is the week long. And so he'll be doing the 2-day next year at our conference again. He told us it was the largest U.S. event he had ever done. Was actually right before XYPN Live, which
yeah,
was awesome.
I actually was there. I was the scribe for that 2-day meeting. It was myself and Scott Frank helping George, and it was so amazing to see the 70 plus financial planners from XYPN and actually outside of XYPN that joined in on this. And there was so much energy in the room both days. I loved it.
Yeah, it just shows there's such a hunger for being able to take the next step as financial planners. And advisors ask, you know, what is the next step? Like, I don't just want to talk to my clients about their portfolios, but I don't know what else to talk to them about. You know, I can't get them to talk about anything else. So we just end up talking about asset classes. And I think that's what George's training really provides, is just the questions to ask and I guess permission to shut up and just listen and hear what they have to say. And, you know, clients have a lot going on in their lives. And so, like, there's always stuff to talk about. We just have to be able to get them to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And having too much of an agenda, I mean, we've sort of changed a bit of the way we do work. And it's thinking about, okay, so let's stay organized on our side. So we understand the direction that we're going for every client. But that doesn't mean that they need the data dump quite yet. And it's really creating that space for them to get their questions answered and making sure that you're taking care of them in the process.
So do you ever find clients say, like, hey, look, I'm not into that mushy-gushy stuff. Like, I'm not interested in going there. Or do you find the folks who ultimately sign on are the ones who are interested in real financial planning and not just, you know, asset management?
So I think we've had a couple people who came on board. I would say of the 39, 2 people wanted to get right to the numbers before really going down this path of life planning. But the fact is that so much of our work ends up incorporating life planning into it that they get a bit of a taste throughout anyways. So those people have actually come around anyways now and have gone through the full process.
I think it's also kind of like the evolution of our firm, right? Like many of your, you know, the people that join your podcast, in the very beginning, you're kind of like, do I do this? Should I do this? Is this the order? And so we were trying that out the past, you know, in the very beginning, we were saying, you know, should we have the life design meeting in the very beginning, or should we wait and answer all their financial questions? And now that we've reached that 1-year mark, we kind of know, we're like, no. We've got to start with a life design meeting. That's the meeting to begin.
It really sets the stage. I mean, one thing that we're incredibly focused on is getting people to live a life that they're really happy about today and not some arbitrary time in the future. So we focus a lot around those short-term goals and really bringing those dreams to reality. Because if you're not meeting those short-term goals, those long-term goals aren't going to fall into place. And so it's giving people the financial confidence and the ability to understand that actually, if you just make a few small changes right now, you can achieve your goals. And so that for us is been really powerful to kind of shift the mindset of like, okay, well, this is what the CFP program tells us that we need to provide exactly, to, okay, actually, let's see what's working and let's optimize this process so it's most time efficient for us, for our clients, and they get the most out of it.
So can you talk me through your meeting sequence? So you have an introductory meeting where you just sort of the prospect meeting. And then what you've been describing is actually the, did you call it the life design meeting? And then what's the additional meetings that then happen?
Yeah. So our process goes into three stages. So the first stage is visioning. And the second stage is the financial life plan. And the third stage is implement and iterate. So talking through the first stage, which is visioning, really it's over a period of 3 to 4 months. And we'll meet with clients every 2 to 4 weeks to become experts on their financial lives. And every meeting's about 90 minutes long. So we spend the first meeting, the introduction meeting, getting organized on their financial picture, understanding their money history, and then really identifying their short, mid, and long-term goals. And so that intro meeting is actually before someone becomes a client. We think it's super important that people that come to us feel like they get very organized on their own. So even if they decide not to move forward with us, that they feel like they got something out of it. The time was well spent. So after the introduction meeting is when someone decides whether or not they become a client. And then from there, the next meeting is what we call our life design meeting. And in that meeting, we create a vision of a moment 1 to 2 years in the future where that individual's living a life that's rich and uniquely theirs. So just really letting them live into that dream of what does their life look like in a time that's really achievable. And so we go through aspects of the evoke process where we talk about obstacles that will keep them from getting there. And most of the time, there aren't any obstacles because if you really talk about what's most important to most people, it's things that already exist in their lives, like spending more time with their family or making sure that they spend time to exercise in the morning. And so just creating that vision really helps people focus on what's most important.
And then the last two meetings before the financial plan delivery are the money flow meeting. So money flow meeting is where we essentially help them structure a budget. And we show them how to do it. We do it interactively with them on eMoney. And then the final meeting before that is before the financial plan is the investment meeting, where we construct an optimal account structure for their personal financial situation. And then we establish preliminary savings and investment strategies for each account.
So it's a pretty time-intensive process over the course of a decent amount of time. This isn't like, you know, two meetings in 2 weeks and call it good. Not that most of our advisors are doing that. So can you talk to me about your fee structure and how you're being compensated for the amount of time and energy that you're putting in?
Yeah, absolutely. So we charge an annual planning fee, and that is charged either quarterly or monthly, depending on what the client prefers. And that annual planning fee is higher in the first year than it is each year thereafter. So just as an example, for an individual, the planning fee starts at $2,500 in the first year and $2,000 for each year thereafter, versus for a couple, it starts at $4,000 and then $2,500 for each year thereafter.
And then are you charging separately for asset management, or is it included in your fee? Sort of how are you handling investment management?
Yeah.
This is a shout out to Scott Gill, who made us do this.
Yeah. Yeah. He really encouraged us to separate the two businesses, and it makes a lot of sense. So we have a completely separate structure for the investments. We charge 0.75% on the first million, and then it scales down from there. And so we decided to do that. So in that investment meeting, in our visioning process, is really where we start to talk about investments for the first time. So, you know, one thing that was really important to us is to really understand somebody's situation before just taking on their investments and presuming that we know what we're doing. So with that in mind, we have that investment meeting. And then at that point, people decide, okay, like, we'd like to invest our money with you. There are people who come on board and they just know right away that they want us to invest their money. So we'll start that process a little sooner, but we still do a lot of these exploration and really understanding of goals and what they want out of that money in order to develop an investment structure that makes the most sense for them.
So of those 39 clients, what percentage or how many of those are having you manage their investments in addition to financial planning?
Sure. So we have 20 investment management clients of the 39, and 4 of those investment management clients are investment only.
Okay. So you have 4 investment only, 35 total that are doing financial planning of the in that are in some capacity, and then what, 15 of those are then also doing investment management.
That's right. And that's of the, I would say the numbers will probably be a little higher by the end of the month, but we're in process. A lot of the people are in process of setting up accounts and things, but that's as of today.
Okay. So what are the ones who are not using your firm for investment management? Do they simply not have investments to manage and it's all tied up in 401ks and retirement accounts? Are they self-managing? Do they have outside investment advisors?
No, most of the clients that don't use us are, you know, they have their assets tied up in either real estate or 401ks. And so, yeah, the answer is that they don't have investments for us to manage.
Okay. So I would expect over time those clients, you know, as they move jobs and want to roll over or something like that, you'll be available to provide that service.
Yeah, we always tell people, I mean, that was my biggest pet peeve, right? Is that, you know, as the Merrill Lynch broker, right? The first meeting is like the Morningstar hypo of like, here's what you have and here's how we can optimize it. And I was just like, no, we cannot do that. For us, it's a no pressure situation for people, though we do have a very robust investment and institutional investment philosophy and strategy. So we educate people on that, but we never say that you have to invest in us.
Yeah, I think by working in the hedge fund field for so long, I know there's a ton of different ways to make money. And I think that's one thing that, you know, a lot of people won't admit is that there are other ways to make money than our precious investment process. But the fact is that there are. And so we look at things on the whole and tell them how we think we can add some value if that's the case. But we're not in the business of convincing someone that we are the best thing ever.
So you've both come from big companies. I mean, you've worked in big company world, and now you are in small company world. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of what the vision is for what you're building and what size firm, what type of firm you really see that, you know, see yourselves growing into?
Yeah, so it continues to evolve. As Stephanie had mentioned, we take every 3 months, we take a step back for a couple of days and say, what can we be optimizing? What's the next step? But just really from a larger scale, you know, at the XYPN Live, we talked about the idea of the small giant versus kind of that larger enterprise firm. And really, I think, you know, we have this natural 3-year window that we're looking at, and before that convertible note changes over. And so really our 3-year vision is to create this small giant firm where, you know, for us, we want to be a multidisciplinary registered investment advisor. And what I mean by that is that we want to hire, when we're hiring, we want to hire different hires. So our first real hire was a friend of ours who is a complete badass. She is a PhD in cognitive science and with a specialization with data visualization. And she's also has a master's in cognitive psychology. So that was our first hire so that she can really help us create this exemplary experience for a wealth management firm. And really our idea is to continue hiring amazing people like that. And then also to train up this next generation, the financial industry, it's no mystery here, but you know, there's not a lot of young people entering our industry. So, you know, our additional hires will be young people that we want to train to love this industry and love this new version of the industry that we're creating.
So the plan is to grow and hire more advisors and be able to train them into, it sounds like, lead planners. The two of you don't see yourselves being the only lead planners, you know, for you know, the foreseeable future.
Yes.
So when we, you know, and listeners have heard me talk about small giants, I think the term that came out of the conference, because we asked our conference attendees to help us name these types of firms, I think boutique was the winner. I need to take a look at that data again. So you are building a boutique firm. But, you know, the point of, you know, making the decision to be great, not necessarily big. And it doesn't mean you can't be big and great. It's just when faced with decisions, and you will be, of, you know, do you want to do something that ultimately takes you a direction that helps you grow a lot faster? Or do you want to take yourself a direction that you feel makes you a better employer, a better financial planning firm, better to your clients, better for the two of you, then, you know, you take that route versus the just grow big. So, you know, looking back, I mean, you know, you've been in business just over a year now. You're, I would say, based on the number of clients, you know, you're still in this sort of this growing phase that I like to call the, oh crap, what did I do phase? Because, you know, and people sometimes think they can skip that phase and you really can't. You can accelerate through it, but you're going to be in it at some point. When you look back over the last year and a half, can you talk to me about some of the maybe one or two big failures that you feel like you've had that you've been able to learn from that listeners could potentially avoid if they hear about someone else's experience?
Sure. Yeah. And it sounds, you know, by the sound of the way that how confident Stephanie and I are, you know, you might think that there weren't any, but there certainly were. And there were times where we both looked at each other and said, like, oh my gosh.
it's always like, we're building a business, so we should love this. That's like the reminder that we have.
We keep reminding ourselves. I'd say like the first, it's a failure and or like a time for, you know, introspection for us. And the first one was really the fees. We know that there's so many advisors that as they go through the first year, they're changed their fees. But really, it was around, I'd say, April of this year, where there was one month where we didn't bring on any new clients. And that was when Stephanie and I looked at each other. We're like, oh, what did we do? And what's going on in our process that's not working? And we asked a couple of clients about this. And then we kind of thought about this. And the failure was in the articulation of our fees. And it was really at that point that we decided to not really charge an upfront fee. We found that there were a lot of people that found that upfront fee very intimidating. And then it's an upfront fee plus a monthly retainer. That language scared the crap out of people. And we decided right then and there that we were going to change that language into an annual planning fee that you can pay either quarterly or monthly. And the moment we did that, we brought on like three new clients because we had actually reached out to the people that had not signed on and had indicated they wanted to sign on. And after that language change, all three of them became clients.
I like that. And that is something that, you know, we're the primary reason for people using the language of upfront plus monthly. And the way you get paid and the way you articulate the service to your clients can absolutely be different. And I love your framing there of it's an annual service, it's an annual fee, but we make it easier for you to pay either monthly or quarterly because we can't accept annual checks. And so it's good to hear that really resonated with your target market and the clients that you wanted to be working with, that really, you know, resonated with them better than upfront plus monthly. I commend you both for being introspective. I think it's the quality that is, I think, impossible to teach. And it just comes from having high EQ. But it is the willingness to you know, ask your clients, like, hey, is this resonating with you? Like, most of us are not willing to ask our clients on, hey, how did that sound? Does this work? Does it not work? Because we don't want to know the answer. And to be willing to pivot and to change and to try new stuff and all of that is so critical. So. All right. Well, as we are wrapping up and coming to a close, I'll ask you both the final question. So as my business coach says, you know, start with the brave one and move left. So whoever wants to be the brave one, you know, if there's one piece of advice that you could go back and give your younger self, one thing that you've learned through starting the business and you know, over the last year and a half, what do you think that one piece of advice would be?
It's funny, Christina and I talk about this a lot because we're big on reflection. And I think we have probably like 20 pieces of advice we would give, but
we actually have one uniform answer for this, Alan, in preparation for this podcast.
Y'all did prepare. So
in your 20s, save as much money as possible. To us, I mean, it's like, that's why we created Mono Money School, is because we both made so many mistakes and there was no one teaching us about how money worked when we were in our 20s. I was an immigrant who had no idea about the American financial system. And I racked up $100,000 of student loan debt and $30,000 of credit card debt in the first year out of school because I had no idea what like credit was or, you know, like how financial systems worked. So both Stephanie and I were very lucky to work really awesome jobs, high paying jobs, and gain a lot of human capital. But, you know, we were also, you know, living in New York City, and then I moved to LA, and Stephanie was in New York for 10 years. And we both kind of, we reflect now and we tell people honestly, like, we didn't save enough in our 20s.
I love that advice, because that's something Kitsis talks a lot about. He was better at it than I was. He's done some podcasts on how he manages his own money, which does involve like having a bunch of cash on hand. And I think his is 2 years of living expenses of, you know, that was where he wanted to be comfortable so that, you know, you could keep expenses low, save as much as you could. And it gives you the flexibility to do things. And we know that intuitively, but at the time it's hard to build in that flexibility. And then all of a sudden you want it and you don't have it. And you have to be intentional about it. So for the younger listeners who may be in college or you know, in your first job that are thinking, hey, I want to start my own firm one day, cut living expenses, save as much as you can, right? Get used to living on less than you make, because when you go to start your firm, you will make less than you make today and be comfortable with that.
Yeah, gosh. And you're right on the flexibility. I mean, it really opens doors to so many things. And if you learn how to save money when you're making probably the least amount of money that you'll ever make when you just graduate from college, you're going to be so set for the rest of your life.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for taking the time to come on the show and share what you've been up to. It sounds like it's been an absolutely exciting, you know, year and a bit, and look forward to hearing about the next couple of years. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
XY Planning Network's annual benchmarking survey is out. Are you curious about the average number of clients XYPN members get in their first year, or how successful niches really are? To answer these burning questions and more, we've again enlisted a professional research firm to complete our annual benchmarking study. Get your copy hot off the press and discover vital statistics such as the median advisor revenue by years in practice and sources of firm growth, from referrals to blogging, social media, and more. Head over to xyplanningnetwork.com/study to purchase your copy today. Be sure to join our VIP community at xyplanningnetwork.com/VIP to hang out with other XYPN radio listeners, ask questions for future mailbag episodes with myself and Kitsis, and to finally find a community of like-minded financial advisors. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll see you next time.
You're not alone, and you're not crazy. It's scary starting, building, and growing your own financial planning firm. And that's why we put together a free private community just for you, the Cutting Edge Financial Planner. Go to xyplanningnetwork.com/VIP or text XYPN Radio to 33344 and join a network of thousands ready to change the lives of Gen X and Gen Y clients.